Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network Weekly Lecture Series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
On behalf of the Armenian National Committee, the Nation Institute, and our other co-sponsors at MIT and Harvard, I welcome you to War, Geopolitics, History, Conflict in the Middle East, a public talk with Robert Fisk, introduced by Noam Chomsky. This is the third leg of a conference organized by the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, which actually began in New York City at New York Society for Ethical Culture, and later on at CUNY Graduate Center. This conference is meant to generate a new critical discussion from a leftist perspective, which ties traditional issues for Armenians, like recognition of the Armenian genocide, to a broader context that includes imperialism, U.S. militarism, women's rights, and many other critical topics to our predicament, and to see how they actually influence the Armenian predicament. I'm now going to introduce Professor Chomsky. I'm going to be quite brief because you're here to hear him, not have me introduce him. Noam Chomsky is one of the country's leading intellectuals and scholars, an MIT professor of linguistics and a longtime activist, prolific writer and popular lecturer. Professor Chomsky speaks widely in a range of social and political issues, both national and international. From linguistics to philosophy, from history to contemporary issues, from international affairs to U.S. foreign policy, Mr. Chomsky's clear, straightforward honesty is legendary. Professor Chomsky's lectured at many universities in the U.S. and abroad, and is the recipient of numerous honorary degrees and awards. His most recent books include A New Generation Draws the Line, New Horizons in the Study of Language and Power, Understanding Power on Nature and Language, Chomsky on Democracy and Education, Middle East Illusions, and Hegemony or Survival. Please welcome Professor Chomsky.
A couple of weeks ago, I had one of many interviews, and this one happened to be on New Zealand radio, and it was about the hottest topic of the day, namely the Middle East. And the interviewer mentioned that he'd just run a marvelous, highly informative interview with Robert Fisk, and he asked where Fisk's regular columns, reports, were published in the United States. And I had to say regretfully that I didn't know of a single one within the mainstream, and quite properly he didn't believe me, so I suggested that he do an internet search, and you might try it. It will be highly instructive. He was right to be amazed for two basic reasons. The first one is that for the past about 30 years, Fisk has been the most respected journalist reporting from the Middle East with incomparable depth and understanding and also extraordinary courage. That's one reason. The second reason is that the Middle East is indeed the hottest topic in the world. It's the primary area of concern for the American public and journalism over a long period, but particularly quite recent, again now. So the Gallup poll just released its review for 2006. The Middle East is the prime concern for the public, the most important problem. When they ask what's the most important problem facing the United States, by far the first, January to March, is the war in Iraq. More than twice as high as the next topic that concerns the public, which is the economy. And the most serious threat perceived is Iran. That doesn't really mean that the public is concerned about Iran. It means that the media and journals and so on tell them that the greatest threat is Iran. There's a strong correlation between most unpopular country and who's receives most defamation in the doctrinal system. The The most foreign coverage over the years, by a long shot, is Israel and matters related to Israel. And might add that the region also provides the topic of least concern to Americans, that is, among topics that are covered at all, at least to judge by the printed word, and that is the fate of the Palestinians. Plenty of coverage, but just contempt and disdain for their rights, dramatically so right now. Well, conclusion from these observations is that that Americans are protected, carefully protected, from the most respected and valuable voices on the topics of their primary concerns, which is something that might merit some concern on our part. The only comparable example that I can think of is the complete exclusion from the media and journals of Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck. Again, you can try an internet search. Now, these are the two distinguished UN diplomats who ran what was called the Oil for Food program. They had hundreds of staff reporting from all over Iraq regularly. They surely knew in close detail about Iraq than the CIA or the Pentagon, which admittedly isn't saying very much, but perhaps more than almost any Westerner. Halliday resigned in 1998, charging the policies, and though they're called UN policies, they're actually US-UK policies. He criticized them as genocidal and didn't want to take part in them anymore. He was replaced by von Sponeck, who resigned 2 years later with very similar charges. Von Sponeck also added that the United States even blocked his reports to the Security Council. But we're lucky the information system in the United States protected the U.S. population from understanding the reality of Iraq and their own massive crimes from the best possible sources they could obtain, counterpart to protecting them from the most important journalism. Well, you'll soon be able to learn about von Sponeck's, about his detailed revelations, very detailed, in a book that is finally supposed to come out in English. It's been out in several other languages. And right now you can discover what you've missed in Robert Fisk's reporting over the years in his monumental book, Great War for Civilization, which just appears. It records his remarkable career and also goes back into plenty of historical background, historical roots, including World War II, and particularly the Armenian genocide and the ways in which it's been barred from history. Actually, it's not really a book for reading. It's too rich and dense for that, and much of it is too painful and horrifying to be able to tolerate for a long stretch. It's really a book to immerse yourself in, repeatedly letting its awful lessons sink in. Now, I don't want to take away from the opportunity to hear Fisky, as he's called by colleagues, so I learned from the book. So let me just mention three of the rich store of searing episodes that he vividly portrays in the book, the merest sample, and very relevant to this moment, though they're from the past. The first incident that I want to mention is the case of the USS Stark. That's a U.S. missile frigate. It was part of the U.S. fleet, which was providing vital support, turned out to be decisive support, for Saddam's murderous aggression against Iran, which killed nobody knows how many hundreds of thousands of people or more. In May 1987, the Stark, patrolling in the Gulf on behalf of Iraq, was hit by two Exocet missiles. It killed 37 crewmen It was known instantly that the attackers were the Iraqi Air Force and Iraqi jet, and President Reagan, in fact, did make an impassioned statement about it, namely that Iran is the villain of the peace. Well, that ended that story. Saddam Hussein was absolved with an apology for regrettable incident. And the example, which is discussed in detail in the book, is quite revealing. The only other country that's permitted to get away with something like that is Israel. In 1967, the attack on the U.S. Liberty, actually under more ambiguous circumstances than the attack on the Stark, and it was also the subject of many bitter denunciations from the highest quarters of the government and the military, and of course the Liberty crew, who are still publishing a journal about it, all to scandalously little effect. However, in the case of the USS Stark, not even that took place. Just gone. It's the fault of Iran. That whole episode does reveal something important. It reveals the unusual and, in fact, quite extraordinary love for Saddam Hussein on the part of the present administration and its immediate mentors. These are facts that are highly relevant today, and they would be on the front pages regularly in anything that pretended to be a free press, along with a great deal more like them. Well, second incident I'd like to mention, also of current relevance, is a year later, the shooting down of Iran Air 655 by the U.S. Super high-tech warship Vincennes in the Gulf, actually in Iranian waters, killing 290 people. It's a commercial airliner. The captain of the nearby U.S. naval vessel, David Carlson, was so horrified by this, he observed it all, that he denounced it in the official Navy Department Journal, the Institute of Naval Affairs, or whatever it's called, the Naval Institute Journal. He denounced it. He wrote there that, in his words, he wondered aloud in disbelief as he observed the downing of what was obviously a civilian airliner taking off from an Iranian base in a commercial corridor, perhaps, he thinks, out of a need to prove the viability of Aegis, its high-tech missile system. This Vincennes was called Robo-Cruiser by the other naval vessels because of its extreme aggressiveness and violence. The same journal, Naval Institute Journal, published an acid review of the Navy Department cover-up of this. The review was by a retired Marine Corps colonel and military historian, David Evans. In it, he quotes a high military officer who was attending the official hearings, the whitewash, and he concluded that our Navy is too dangerous to deploy. Well, that was taken care of by President Bush, number one, who said, I will never apologize for the United States of America. I don't care what the facts are. Takes care of that one. Turned out he was not the only one who didn't care what the facts are. I learned from the book that Fisk's very dramatic report from the scene was too much for his newspaper to handle, the London Times. For the first time, he reports, they eviscerated his account. They cut out the details that incriminated Washington, and they even sank to the level of adding a ridiculous Thatcher-Bush propaganda charge about how the plane might have been on a suicide mission. Fisk reacted by resigning after many years with the Times, and since then it's his reports from the London Independent from which Americans have to be protected and have been effectively. Well, both of these events are highly relevant to what's going on right now, the crisis over Iran. For those who hold the clubs, typically, history is bunk. It's old-fashioned, boring, antiquated, put it aside as we move on to a glorious future. The victims don't have that luxury. So Iranians remember that the U.S. has been torturing them without a stop for over half a century, without a break. The support for Saddam's murderous aggression is only one case, and the two incidents that I just took from the Great War for Civilization, those two incidents brought Iran to the recognition that they would have to capitulate to the U.S.-Saddam alliance, to the aggression. They surely haven't forgotten that, along with much else. Well, third incident is different. It's perhaps the most moving report I've ever read by Fisk or any other journalist that I can think of, and that's his account of his flight from American bombing in Afghanistan in December 2000. He was with a crowd of people who, now quote him, were desperate and angry and mourning their newly slaughtered loved ones, slaughtered under B-52 bombs. In this crowd, he was mistaken for an American, badly beaten, tried to kill him, barely escaped with his life through the intervention of some notable, probably a mullah. I can't try to reproduce Fisk's sensitive and thoughtful account of this terrible incident. It's, of course, laced with fear and anger, but also sympathy for those who almost killed him and were trying to kill him, and understanding of what led them to that savagery. Well, this is actually one of the rare cases where Fisk did make it to the U.S. press, even to U.S. scholarship. So his account was featured by a revered moral philosopher, academic specialist on what's called just war, Jean Belka Elstein. She wrote that by daring to comprehend the reaction of refugees to someone they understandably took to share responsibility for their misery, Fisk carried absurdity to a preposterous extreme. Worse still, he was also guilty of racism for reporting that his white skin may have saved him. And that sanctifies any evil perpetrated by the oppressed race, according to Andrew Sullivan, former editor of The New Republic, who she quotes. That's the bastion of American liberal intellectual life. Its next editor went beyond that and featured the same piece, Fisk's piece, in what it calls its Idiot Watch. That's a regular listing of work that descends to pure idiocy. So the point is, they didn't make it, have to explain it. The point is that no one but a pure idiot could believe that Afghans might not celebrate watching their children torn to shreds by noble American B-52s. Well, for full disclosure, I should add that I've made it to the same list. Now you have the unusual privilege of hearing one leading idiot introduce another member of that august company. And I can only urge that you listen carefully, and we're all certain to learn a lot that we shouldn't hear, according to our guardians. Thanks.
Noam, this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship. I'm glad you were told to turn off your mobile phones, ladies and gentlemen, because some months ago in Dublin, Ireland, I said that anyone whose mobile phone rang when I was speaking would be sold into slavery. And immediately a mobile phone rang, and it was mine. So it's still on now, so you can answer your phones if you want. It's a newsroom, no problems. I'm not going to try and give you a hard sell on my book. At 1,300 pages in the English edition, it's impossible. But I will try and tell you about partly what it taught me about the Middle East to write it, and how its purpose changed, because the book I wrote is not the one I started writing. It took 20 months to do. And I think at the end of the day, while it started off trying to explain the privilege of watching history, it ended up talking about the curse of watching history. And I think the theme that came out of it for me, which I guess is the one I think about, is our need to refuse to accept the narrative of history as it is laid down by our presidents and our prime ministers and our generals and our journalists for the most part. It's also a book about my father, because 19-year-old Second Lieutenant Bill Fisk of the 12th Battalion, the King's Liverpool Regiment, who was much older than my mum, she wasn't born at the time, was a soldier in the First World War. He was sent to the trenches of France in August 1918, just before the end of that war. And just before the end, he was also ordered to carry out the execution of a young Australian soldier, 19 years old, the same age as him, who was found guilty of killing a British military policeman in Paris. And my father, who in later years was a very conservative man, he called black people niggers, he was a racist man. He liked magistrates and capital punishment and police stations, policemen. He refused to execute his Australian comrade. And I think, looking back now, that that was one of the finest things he ever did in his life. He also refused the narrative of military life that was laid down for him. When he died, aged 93, in 1992, I inherited his campaign medals. And on the back of his 1914-1918 medal was written the words, "The Great War for Civilization." And immediately I knew that, ironically, that had to be the title of my book. Because in 17 months that followed Bill Fisk's First World War, the victors, primarily the British and the French, of course, drew the borders of Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, and most of the Middle East. And I've spent my entire professional career in Belfast and Belgrade, and we love onomatopoeia, we journalists, and Beirut and Baghdad, watching the people in these borders burn. So the book was also very much a disturbing volume to write. After the beginning of the first 200 pages, I realized that there wouldn't even be any shred of my normal black humor coming into the book. About on page 200, I record how Jon Snow, now a big anchorman on Channel 4 in Britain, and then humble reporter like me, he's still an old mate of mine, he and I, for reasons too boring to explain to you, found ourselves having to rescue the crew of a British ship which was stuck in the Shatt al-Arab River with missiles from Iran and Iraq going each side of the hull. John, with flippers, went off with a bunch of Iraqi commandos. They were the good guys at the time. We loved the Iraqis. They were invading Iran. Later on, when they invaded Kuwait, it was the wrong thing around. But in these days, they were the good guys. So he went off with the Iraqis, and I, poor old Bob, stayed on the shore in the darkness, and my job was to pull the rope attached to the lifeboat, which had been lowered from the British ship in the middle of the night, while bullets whizzed around at hip height, because all the dogs on the island, which had been abandoned by their owners, could sniff that Bob was there, and were going, "Arr, arr, arr, arr," which was great if you were standing in front of the Iranian front line. Anyway, I pulled the boat over with John and the crew in. Being a British ship, most of the crew, of course, were Sri Lankan and Indian and Pakistani. And the worst moment in their lives came when Bob pulled them ashore and found that on board the boat they'd also brought all their duty-free colour televisions and refrigerators, which they'd bought in Dubai before they set off on their doomed and luckless journey to the Iran-Iraq border. And my job, which John agreed I would have to do because we had to race back across this island, which was partly underwater, was to get each colour television set and each refrigerator and chuck it back into the Shatt al-Arab River. In any event, I went down to see a dear friend of mine, and sitting in my library at home as I was writing, and I said, "You know, that's the last happy story in the book." And she said, "Ah, that is the end of the sweet stories." And that is how I begin the next paragraph. So if you do read the book, when you get to there, watch out, because the rest of the book is an almost unrelieved pageant of torture, suffering, pain, betrayal, national and international treachery, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. I must say that I reached the end of this book, and this often when I have repeated it elsewhere to American audiences, brings a drawing in of breath. When I reached the end of my book, of 80 years of duplicity in the Middle East, I found myself amazed at how much restraint Muslims had shown towards the West. I also tried to question what our job was as foreign correspondents, what my job should be. I had a conversation more than 2 years ago with that very fine Israeli journalist, Amira Haas, on Haaretz about this very question. And I, being a Brit, of course, I said, oh, well, you know, our job is to write the first pages of history so that people can never say, we didn't know, no one told us. And Amira said, no, Robert, you're wrong. Our job is to monitor the centers of power, to challenge authority, especially when they want to go to war, especially when they're going to kill people and tell lies to do it. And that, I think, is the best definition I've ever heard of what our job should be in my life. And it's now the definition I use, always, of course, copywriting it to Amira. But there is a big problem. And it's one of the things, the main thing I want to talk to you about today, and maybe hear you and even Noam again on this same subject. And that is, how do we get it so wrong? How do we get it, we journalists, how do we manage not to inform you? You know, I've always thought it's remarkable. I mean, Noam says I don't have a regular column in an American paper. Here is the man who should have a regular column in an American paper. And so should the late Edward Said have had a regular column in American paper. And shame upon the American media that they didn't have and don't have. What's gone wrong in the American press? You know, I ask myself this partly because I have a lot of friends among the American journalists working in the Middle East. I enjoy having dinner with them. But the odd thing is that when I'm at dinner with them, I learn quite a lot. They know a lot. But when I open the paper in the morning, it's so boring I could fall asleep. Their knowledge isn't there. I remember my colleague Patrick Coburn in Baghdad telling me that at one point of great violence in Baghdad, he saw an American colleague crawling out on his balcony to use his satellite phone to talk to somebody. And afterwards he said, you know, what, because there were a lot of bullets flying around, what was the problem? Who were you talking to? He said, I was ringing someone up at the Brookings Institution. We needed a quote about what was going on in Iraq. You see the problem. I mean, there is this osmotic, parasitic relationship which your journalists, and some of ours too, have with power. You only have to watch, I was going to say watch CNN, don't watch CNN. You only have to watch a presidential press conference from the White House to see how the relationship works. Mr. President, Mr. President, Mr. Yes, Bob. Yes, John. See, that's how it works. Close to power, have access. When I was doing a book launching tour, and by the way, it's getting really, I've done New Zealand, Australia, Belgium, Norway, and here in 1.5 weeks. So if I seem to be wandering at any point, I am. I'm sitting in LA having my morning coffee, and I open my Los Angeles Times, which will show you I was in LA on November the 16th, 2005. I'm going to show you one of the problems with your journalism, okay? This is a story on the front page, which you can see. In a battle of wits, Iraq's insurgency mastermind, we love masterminds, don't we, stays a step ahead of the United States. By Josh Meyer and Mark Mazzetti, Times staff writers, Washington. Good place to write about Iraq from, by the way. Try it. The first paragraph, despite the recent arrest of one of his would-be suicide bombers in Jordan and some top aides in Iraq, insurgency mastermind Abu Musab Zarqawi, he might not even be alive for all I know, has eluded capture, U.S. authorities say, because his network has a much better intelligence-gathering operation than they do. Wow. Now, first of all, I don't think Zarqawi may be even alive, and I doubt very much if he's got much of an intelligence-gathering operation. The problem is that when you set off on an ideological war, you can have all the mainframe computers you like, and as much Humint as you like, and as big CIA central station as you want. If it's an ideological war, you won't understand what you're listening to. I'll give you a perfect example of that. 5 weeks before the Anglo-American invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, Bin Laden made an audio tape which no one listened to. Well, we did. We said, and the Pentagon said, and the press said, was it him? Is he ill? How long ago did he make the broadcast finish? But what he actually said in that tape was he called upon Iraqi Muslims who supported him to join with socialists in the future battle against the American crusaders. These are his words. Socialists, he meant the Ba'ath Party. He meant the soldiers of the Iran-Iraq war, the soldiers of the Iraqi army. This was the detonator which was going to bring us the suicide bomber and the trained Iraqi soldier in one insurgency. This was the warning, and none of us... How many people here actually read that at the time? There's one hand, two hands. I missed it, three hands. Okay, you three did better than I did. I was sitting in Baghdad at the time. How incredible. There it was, and we didn't pick it up. No wonder Mr. Zarqawi has such good intelligence. But let me read you the rest of this report, just bits of it, and you mustn't laugh. I'm going to read you the sourcing of the report. Paragraph one, as you know, U.S. authorities say. Column one still, U.S. officials said. Said one U.S. Justice Department counterterrorism official. Column two, officials said, U.S. authorities say, U.S. officials said. We're going over to A10 page now, so you can look it up on the Google, which I don't use. Here we go. Column one, several U.S. officials said, those officials said, the officials confirmed, American officials complained, they said, U.S. officials stressed, column three, U.S. authorities believe, said one senior U.S. intelligence official, U.S. officials said, Jordanian officials said. We've got a slight... No laughter, please. We haven't finished yet. Several U.S. officials said, column four, U.S. officials said, several American officials said, officials say U.S. officials, but U.S. officials said, one U.S. counterterrorism official said. I'm not joking. There it is. That is the journalism you're getting fed. And I sometimes think the LA Times and the New York Times should be called American Officials Say. And we can cut out... And we can cut out the journalists. No more problems. It isn't the only kind of reporting I object to. Let me try this one on you. This is an AP report published in the New York Times on the 24th of January, not long ago. Also, of course, on Fox News. I'll read you just a few extracts from here and see if you can spot the point. You will. Fort Carson, Colorado, January 23, The Associated Press. A military jury ordered a reprimand, but no jail time Monday, for an army interrogator convicted of negligent homicide in the death of an Iraqi general, who died after he stuffed him headfirst into a sleeping bag and sat on his chest. The interrogator, Chief Warrant Officer Lewis Welshoffer Jr., also was ordered to forfeit $6,000 in salary and largely restricted to his barracks and workplace for 60 days. Way down the story, in paragraph 6, we learn that the Iraqi general is actually Major General Abed Hamad Malhoush. He has an identity in paragraph 6. Until then, none at all. Here we go. Earlier in the day, during the sentencing hearing, Mr. Welshoffer fought back tears. I deeply apologize, he said, if my actions tarnished the soldiers serving in Iraq. One would have thought the apologies might have gone to the family of the general, if he has one. But we don't know that. What we do know is that Mr. Welshoffer has a family because, as we learn later on in the story, his wife, Barbara, testified that she was worried about providing for their three children if her husband was sentenced to prison. But she said she was proud of him for contesting the case. I love him more for fighting this, she said, tears welling up in her eyes. Everybody's crying in this court case. He's always said that you need to do the right thing, and sometimes the right thing is the hardest thing to do. Torture is tough, ladies and gentlemen, believe me. So here we have, there's another lovely line here I better tell you, is that they believed, here we are, officials believe, the officials are here too, officials believe Malhoush, the general, had information that would break the back of the whole insurgency. He knew 40,000 insurgents, so they stuffed him inside a sleeping bag and sat on his chest. But what's really wrong with this story is, did the general not have a family? Did he not have three children? Who was providing for them now? But it's missing. And I don't think the reporter who wrote this AP story for a single moment saw anything wrong in it. Shouldn't we know that this person was also a human being? This is exactly the same problem that we have because in our reporting of Iraq today, because I don't think we care about Iraqis. In fact, I don't think we care about many people in the Middle East. You know, why is it that President Bush can say, 30,000 Iraqis have been killed, more or less. Well, more or less. Which? Would he have said, 2,000 Americans have been killed, more or less? I doubt it. We rightly honor the sacrifice of our dead soldiers, but we do not give any honor to the massive suffering of the Iraqis. In August of last year, I went, as I often do, to the main mortuary in Baghdad to count corpses. There were 9 by 9 a.m., 26 by midday. Many of them hands tied behind their backs, blindfolded, woman and baby included, shot in the head. Death squads are roaming Baghdad, as we now know. When I was there, the mortuary officials, who know me very well by now, allowed Mr. Bob to have a look at the computer screen hooked into the Ministry of Health in Baghdad, which is banned, of course, to Western journalists on the orders, specifically of the American and British occupying powers. And this computer showed that in July alone, 1,100 Iraqis, in just July, in only Baghdad, had died by violence. Now, you spread that through Mosul, Kirkuk, Erbil to some extent, Bakuba, Ramadi, Fallujah, Amara, Samarra, Najaf, Karbala, Basra. You must be talking of 3,000 a month, 36,000 a year. Not 30,000 more or less since April of 2003. That 100,000 figure that my own dear Prime Minister Tony Blair made fun of may well be quite conservative, but we don't care about the Iraqis. We don't care about their suffering. It's always, the lowest months so far for American casualties. Well, good, but the highest month so far for the Iraqis is not the headline. It's very odd the way in which this constant pitter-patter of our concern for our blue-eyed friends only come through in this narrative. I'll give you another example of this kind of journalism that makes me gulp. Here is the Associated Press doing its job. The AP, through the Freedom of Information Act, and I wish ours worked as well as yours did, by the way, got 6,000 documents, official American government documents from Guantanamo. Here's Fisk is doing his wandering odyssey again. The Sydney Morning Herald turns up at my breakfast table in Australia. US papers tell Guantanamo inmate stories. Well, yeah, that's okay. That's what it's about. But the real story is buried in the box. Here is a quote. This is, remember, an official American document. This is a quote about the trial in the Drumhead military courts of Feroz Ali Abbasi. He's a Brit, actually, who's since been released and complained about torture in Guantanamo. And Abbasi, according to this official American document, stands in court and says, please tell me what I'm accused of. Under international law, I have the right to know. And here is the quote from the Air Force colonel who was the judge at this Guantanamo mock trial, and who I think does not deserve to wear his uniform, who said, Mr. Abbasi, your conduct is unacceptable, and this is your absolute final warning. I do not care about international law. I do not want to hear the words international law again. We are not concerned about international law. Yeah. And it's way down the story. No wonder you didn't all read it. That surely should be the headline, I ask myself. On the 11th of September 2001, I was crossing the Atlantic towards you. When my plane took off from Europe, I'd already heard from my office that one aircraft, we thought it was a light aircraft, had flown into one of the towers of the World Trade Center. Once I was in the air, I called up my office on the satellite plane's phone in my seat, which proves I was traveling business class, doesn't it? Anyway, I talked to London, and they said it's an airliner, and there's another one. So I thought, this isn't a tragedy, this is an attack. And then we heard a helicopter at the Pentagon, which turned into another airliner, then we had Pennsylvania. And I went up, because I know many of the crews, because I travel the Atlantic so many times, I went up to the chief person, the stewardess, and said, look, you better tell our captain, I knew him actually, that America is under attack. And the pilot came straight back. I said, Robert, call London, tell me everything more you can learn. I did. And the stewardess said to me, there must have been a lot of them. It's unprecedented. She said, where did the planes come from? At that stage, we didn't know that they were domestic, fully fueled flights. We thought they could have come from Latin America or Africa or Europe. And the purser and I looked at each other. And we went round our aircraft looking for passengers we didn't like. I found 13. 3 in business class. He found 14. And of course, They were the same ones. They were Muslims, weren't they? And we picked them out because they had worry beads or beards or were looking suspiciously at Bob because he was looking suspiciously at them. Or were doing the dastardly sin of reading the Quran, you know, on a flight. And I got back to the front of the aircraft and I realized that in 3 minutes, Bin Laden, and I was sure it was him, had turned nice, friendly, liberal Bob into a racist. I was racially profiling the passengers on my aircraft, wasn't I? He was not dividing Muslims from the West. We don't say Muslims from Christians because we don't have so many Christians left now, but Muslims. He was dividing the innocent from the innocent. And all it needed to solidify that vengeful theory and to open the gates to torture and rendition and abuse and murder was for one person to say, September the 11th, 2001 has changed the world. And we all know who said that. And indeed, so did Mr. Blair. What was very interesting, however, was when I got back to Europe again, turned on the television, that my phone was ringing like a budgerigar mobile phone from NBC, CBS, CNN. All they wanted to know was, who was it Bin Laden and how? Okay, who? 19 Arabs who claimed they were Muslims. How? Box cutters, aeroplanes, tall buildings. The one question they did not want to ask was why. And from my aircraft, I actually dictated two stories to London before it returned. Of course, we turned round off the west coast of Ireland when America closed its airspace. I dictated two reports to my paper. One was saying that in the coming days, we will not be permitted to ask why, because it will open a door to the Sykes-Picot Agreement, to the Balfour Declaration, to Lawrence of Arabia, to the aftermath of the First World War, and on and on and so forth. And the other article I wrote was saying, I don't believe in pointing the finger, but when there is an attack on this scale, and this was, after all, an international crime against humanity, we have a right to say who has declared war on the United States, and Bin Laden had. And the last time I met him, out of three occasions, the last words he said to me, we were sitting in one of his camps on the top of a mountain in Afghanistan, a camp originally built by the CIA, of course, and he said, Mr. Robert, from this mountain upon which you're sitting, we defeated the Russian army and destroyed the Soviet Union. Bit of an exaggeration, but with a certain amount of truth in there. Then he said, and I pray to God that he permits us to turn America into a shadow of itself. And when Victoria, my researcher, found my notebook, along with 328,000 other documents, files, newspaper clippings, photographs and videotapes, she found that on the side of that quote, I'd written two vertical lines on each side of the page and put rhetoric, question mark. And I can tell you, when I saw on the television over and over again the Twin Towers descending in that biblical epic horror and all that smoke and fire crossing Manhattan, I said to myself, well, New York is now a shadow of itself. But what was particularly interesting was the venom that I received, both on the BBC and on the radio stations, when I did start to say why. I was on an Irish radio show with Eamon Dunphy when I was hooked in to a well-known Harvard professor who shall remain nameless. It was Alan Dershowitz, of course it was, yes. Who said that because I was asking the question why, I was pro-terrorist, anti-American, that I was a dangerous man, and that to be anti-American was the same as being anti-Semitic. I've got it on tape, by the way. But you see, I got the message. To ask the question why was so dangerous that you would be a Nazi if you asked it. Indeed, following my articles, I started receiving a number of postcards from this country, all written with the same language, of course, in different places, saying that my mother was Adolf Eichmann's daughter. Now, my mum was in the Royal Air Force in 1940 repairing radios on damaged Spitfires that had been shot down by the Luftwaffe. But that, of course, didn't matter. We actually had a series of campaign emails into the Independent in London. We don't care about if it's a political campaign, we bin them. Your papers don't, unfortunately. You take them seriously. One lovely one came in from Texas saying, after reading Robert Fisk's Bilge, I will never buy your magazine again. Now, not only do we, alas, not sell in Texas, we certainly are a newspaper, not a magazine, but you get the general drift. But you see, some of us did have a feeling that something was coming. I've gone back with Victoria's help through all the videotaped interviews I was doing prior to 2001, 9/11. And one of the most interesting moments comes in a CBC interview in Toronto when I said I'm very pessimistic about the way things are going at the moment. We have a very dangerous situation on our hands in the Middle East. He said, oh, I don't know what the problem would be here. I mean, we've got, we've got peace between Israel and Egypt, peace between Israel and Jordan. Always the peace and security of Israel is the benchmark of whether things are going okay in the Middle East. And I said, no, an explosion, some kind of explosion is coming. And I've looked back and I've gone through that tape. I don't know what I meant. Maybe I meant political explosion. But some of my colleagues, particularly my Arab journalistic colleagues, also were saying the same thing at the time. We knew somehow something was going to happen. Back in 1993, I made a series of films called Beirut to Bosnia, and the subhead to them was how Muslims are coming to hate the West. Dismissed as sensationalist in the New York Times. It was shown on the Discovery Channel only once, because then, of course, AIPAC and others attacked it, and on Channel 4 in Britain. And at one point in the film sequence, we filmed in Beirut, southern Lebanon, Israel, Palestine still in quotes for me, in Gaza, West Bank, Egypt, Bosnia, Croatia, and Poland, because we also looked at the Holocaust in the film, Jewish Holocaust. And at one point in the film, I am in Bosnia, and I go into a village called Chela. I'm going to show you the sequence right now, or Doug will show it. If it all works all right, I don't trust technology, which is why I don't use email or the internet. I go into a village called Chela, which is a Muslim village captured by the Serbs a year earlier, when the Serbs had told me they were going to look after the mosque and the Muslims in the village. So a year later, the Independent sends me back to this village. As you see me walk into the mosque, I'll tell you now, Victoria and I found out that the actual day we walked into that mosque was September the 11th, 1993. It was 8 years before, to the moment. But when I edited this sequence to show you, you can understand why I drew in my breath when I heard what I say on the soundtrack as I walk into the bombed mosque. Can we shoot ahead and lights down and so on? This is always the moment when I hold my breath. If we have that light down at the back too, please. If we can get the light down at the back, that would be great.
Easily we reporters accepted this phrase. The Muslims who lived in these devastated homes were raped and murdered by the Serbs, not because they were ethnically different from their Serb attackers, but because the Serbs wanted the Muslims' land, and they got it. Our reports of their plunder made no difference. A year ago, the Independent sent me into Serbia and Bosnia to search for a village in which Muslims still lived. I found a village called Chela. It had a pretty mosque and a friendly imam who lived in a cottage next door. The Serbs promised to protect them. Now I was going back to see them again, accompanied by two watchful Serb policemen.
I'm sure it's a mosque. I went in there before.
Keep going. This is, I'm sure.
Yes, sir, I never went to go in there before. This is a mosque.
See it, Paul?
So I'm going to go on talking to you while we get the picture worked out. Ah, maybe we'll get it worked out. Can you do it? Yeah, try it again. Okay, we'll try it again. A slightly younger Bob Fiske on this film, I have to say. If we get it there. 1993, September
11th. Is
that Jamie
was listening?
It's,
No. Well, it worked okay, yes. So no lamp, we'll just abandon there. Basically, as I walk into the mosque, what I say is, when I see things like this, of course the mosque has been burned out and bombed out, when I see things like this, I wonder what the Muslims have in store for us. Maybe I should end each of my reports with the words, watch out. That's what I was about to say when the film and the film cut there. And of course, I go into the house of the imam. It's been burned out. His photographs of the family are lying on the floor. And then I go to the railway station where the people from this same village are being heaped onto trains and sent off and can't even tell me what life was like because they're weeping. In any event, it's a story which, of course, was repeated again and again in Bosnia when we spent much of our time saying it was a civil war, that it was not. I think you might as well abandon it, actually, rather than have funny pictures come up. What we kept saying, it was a civil war, therefore we didn't have to be involved. And it was only when 750,000 Muslims in Bosnia were dead that we actually did eventually intervene. But let me go back to the much more powerful issue of Iraq, which is what really should be dominating our discussions today. I think it's almost impossible to report Iraq at the moment. I'm not really surprised, frankly, because the Americans are happy that we can't move around. As journalists, it has now got to a stage where, for the first time in my life, as a foreign correspondent, I'm not sure if the risk is worth the story or the story is worth the risk. And believe me, the American military like it like that, because we can't go and check that when they say 32 terrorists have been killed in this village, that there aren't a lot of women and children there too. Although when the Iraqi film comes back, there often are. But the real problem, you see, is that we're now divided in between what I call hotel journalism and mouse journalism. Hotel journalism is where the reporter arrives at the airport, is helicoptered to the green zone, and goes into a hotel and uses the Baghdad dateline, but doesn't leave the hotel. He uses his mobile phone to call the Iraqi government in the green zone, or the American embassy, or the British embassy. The New York Times, for example, now lives and does occasionally travel up, but lives in a massive stockade with four watchtowers, guarded by young Iraqis with rifles, all of whom, by the way, have black T-shirts with New York Times written on. This is journalism today. I don't actually mind those reporters who don't leave the hotel because, frankly, you know, if you have family, your editor tells you you can't, your security detail, a lot of reporters travel with armed men, we don't on The Independent, but many do, you know, what can he do? What I do object to is that the reporter does not tell the reader or the viewer or the listener that he doesn't leave the hotel, thus giving the impression it's possible to do a tour d'horizon of Baghdad and to check out stories, when in fact he doesn't do that. He might as well be in County Mayo or MIT using his mobile phone to call in the green zone. But the alternative, you see, is what I try to do and what Patrick Coburn does and a few of us, or the rest of us, and that's what I call mouse journalism. I'll give you an example. This has actually happened a few months ago. I was in Baghdad. Two bombs are blown up by suicide bombers at a bus station used by Shiite Muslims. I rush to the scene with my two Iraqi friends at a beat-up old black car. I jump out of the car. I get one picture of a woman burning next to a bus. I have 20 seconds interviewing an eyewitness, and then 40 or 50 Iraqis beating on the roof of my car, and so I drive away at speed. Mouse journalism. Off I go. That gives me 400 or 500 words in the paper, but is it worth the risk? Is it worth the risk? You know, we still ask ourselves, was it for oil? Strange how oil has even disappeared out of the narrative now. Now it's, will there be a civil war? If you want to really understand Iraq, you've got to read Doonesbury, by the way. I read Doonesbury in Iraq. And it's the best account of what I'm seeing around me. I don't know if you've seen the latest episodes. Bush is in the White House trying to say, well, you know, we can't use weapons of mass destruction. We can't use the links between Saddam and we can't use democracy at the moment. And we can't use things are getting better. And someone says, well, how about stop the civil war? He said, that's what it'll be. And the next scene is in the desert with all these poor soldiers dripping perspiration. It's getting very hot in Iraq. And one of them says, okay, Ben, stop the civil war, mount up. You see, that's what we're doing now. We're trying to stop a civil war. Or are we? You know, I don't believe that all the Sunni Muslims want to go around blowing up Shiite mosques. And I don't believe that the Shiites are all going around trying to burn down Sunni mosques. There has never been, ever, a civil war in Iraq. It is not a sectarian society, as those stupid maps suggest. You know, Kurds at the top, Sunnis in the middle, Shiites at the bottom. Imagine if we thought you were going to have a civil war. We'd have, you know, black areas of Washington, white areas of Baltimore. We'd have WASPs here, Catholics here, born-again Christians there. I mean, imagine the matrix in this country. But no, in Iraq and in the Middle East, it's okay to say Druze, Shiites, Sunnis, Maronites, etc. We divide them up. I remember the first person who said the word civil war was the spokesman for the American occupation forces in August 2003 in the Green Zone. I remember taking notes and thinking, what? Civil war? What is this danger of civil war I've heard about? Where? Why? What for? I was interviewing a doctor who was shot dead, the brother of a doctor who was shot dead in his surgery in Baghdad, probably because he'd objected to the building of a Shiite Muslim mosque at the end of his street, probably killed by Shiites. And afterwards, I was sitting next to the brother of the doctor in the funeral feast, a very grisly affair that some of you may have even taken part in, lots and lots of overcooked meat. And sitting next to the brother of the doctor, I said, New York Times style, so will there be a civil war in Iraq? And he said, Mr. Robert, he said, you know, we're all intermarried. We're a tribal society. My wife is a Shiite. Do you want to kill my wife, he said? This is not, you know, one of those little apocryphal stories. This is the voice of an Iraqi. He said, why do you Westerners want us to have a civil war? Are you trying to make us frightened and obedient through the fear of civil war? Someone wants a civil war in Iraq. By goodness, they do. But look at this whole story we hear that men in police uniforms take Margaret Hassan hostage, Margaret Hassan of CAIR, who was later brutally murdered in front of a video camera. Over and over again, we're hearing men in police uniforms kidnap X, kidnap Y, or men in military uniforms take over a police station. Are we supposed to believe that there is a warehouse in Fallujah with 8,000 police uniforms made to measure so that insurgents and suicide bombers can come along and take the uniform that fits them? No, I don't believe so for a moment. You know, back in Algeria, we had the same issue. We had what were called faux barrages, false checkpoints, manned by men in police uniforms at night. And it took me 3 months in Algeria before I realized that at some time around 6:05, the real policemen turned into insurgents. And what's happened is that the insurgents have so infiltrated the police and military in Iraq that they are totally untrustworthy force. That's why many of them are wearing hoods in front of US troops when I turn up at the scene of bomb explosions. They're there. I actually spent a day with the Iraqi police force. You can imagine what it was like going to the Interior Ministry in Baghdad and said, please, can I spend a day with your policeman? And to my horror, they said, yes. And I set off, and what was very interesting about this, we had a thin skin car, no flak jackets, they had some Kalashnikovs and a couple of rounds. At one point, they ran out of gas, and the independent had to buy petrol at a petrol station for their police vehicle. But what was interesting is that when we set off, they complained to me and said, please, can you get the Americans to give us better weapons? And then they talked about terrorists. By lunchtime, they were talking about Mujahideen, holy warriors. By the afternoon at around 3:30, and I began to see the clock ticking towards 6:05, they were talking about how the Americans were really getting it from the insurgents now, and the patriots were really knowing how to fight, right? So I was kind of happy at 4:00 when my driver turned up and said, Mr. Robert, we'll go home now. Because who knows what would have happened 2 hours later. But you see, they were, of course, if not insurgents, they were sympathizers with those Iraqis opposing the occupation. Two were Sunnis and one was Shia. There you go. They weren't fighting each other. They were talking about fighting occupation. So these are questions. Look, did we go for oil? Simple answer. If the major export of Iraq was asparagus, do you believe the 82nd Airborne would be in Mosul? Or the 3rd Infantry Division in Baghdad? But there's another reason. I was south of Baghdad on the notorious Highway 8, a horrible throat-cutting road where journalists had been killed, investigating the death, the murder of a poor Red Cross driver and interviewing an Iraqi family whom I think probably saw the murderers, the gunmen. And as I was talking to them, the ground began to tremble. And up the road came the biggest military convoy I have ever seen in my life, bigger than any of the Soviet ones in Afghanistan. It took 1.75 hours to pass. Abrams M1, A1 tanks, Bradley fighting armored vehicles, Humvee, truck after truck. Hundreds and hundreds, thousands of troops, all with their rifles pointing out the side of the trucks like porcupine quills, Apache helicopters over the top. And I sat in the muck beside the road along with the Iraqi families, just watched them pass. And I thought, you know, 2,000 years ago, a little bit further west, I'd have been sitting somewhere in Syria and it would have been a tramp of Roman legions passing me. Because I think that a superpower has a visceral need to project military strength. The British did. The Romans did. The Romans actually almost got into the Iraqi desert when they got massacred by Parthians, who would be Syrians or Iraqis today. The Roman general Crassus, the man who defeated Spartacus at the Battle of the River Silarus in 72 BC, he had his head chopped off and it was sent back to Rome. Faint familiarity there. When I got back to Baghdad, I was talking to an Iraqi friend. He said, Mr. Robert, you know, you talk about military power. He said, can you explain something to me? And this is Iraq through the glass darkly from the other side, not the version you see in your papers. He said, can you tell me why the American military, in some form or another, you know, special forces, air bases, infantry divisions, he said, can you tell me why the American forces are in Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, Jordan, Israel, Turkey, Egypt, Algeria, special forces based in Etam and Rasset now in the southern Sahara Desert, Oman, Yemen, they're in Qatar, they're in Bahrain, they're in Kuwait. He said, can you tell me why? What are they there for? Pakistan? And in fact, you can actually go further north and south and say that the American Iron Curtain runs from Greenland through Britain, Germany, Yugoslavia, they're in Bosnia, Greece, and to Turkey. So we have this Iron Curtain running from the ice cap to the borders of Somalia. Why? What's on the other side of it? Oh, Iran is in the middle. I don't think Iran's a big danger to anybody. Pakistan is. They've actually got a bomb and lots of Taliban followers. But no, it's Iran that hasn't yet broken the law, who's got to be the center of crisis. Another part of the narrative of current events, which of course we have to follow because our presidents and prime ministers and generals and our journalists tell us that that's the problem. But no, on the other side of that Iron Curtain is India, China, and Russia. And don't tell me the Indians and the Chinese and the Russians haven't thought about that. But this is more of the questions, why? What are we doing? Is this really about the projection of American power or something else? You know, I keep going back to these same issues of why and how and what do we do. And I think that journalists, as well as their notebooks, should always carry a suitcase full of history books. One of the most amazing things I discovered in writing this far too long a book, it was meant to be 750 pages, is that the way in which we Westerners always go to the Middle East to rescue people. We go with our swords and our horses and our Apaches and our Bradley fighting armored vehicles, and we're always going to rescue them. You know, Napoleon, at the time of the French expedition to Egypt in the 18th century, Napoleon issued a manifesto to the people of Cairo saying he was going to save them from being hanged by the Pashas who didn't believe in free speech. In 1917, the British Army invaded Iraq and occupied it, led by General Sir Angus Maud. Maud put up a proclamation on the streets of Baghdad in the late autumn of 1917. Private Charles Dickens of the Cheshire Regiment, which was another regiment my father was in, peeled it off the wall, put it in his rucksack where it obtained the yellowing stains of his own perspiration in the following Iraqi summers, gave it later to his daughter, who sold it to me for $2,000 just before our 2003 invasion of Iraq. And on this document, which is English one side and Arabic on the other, and it hangs beside my desk where I wrote this book, it says, to the people of the Muhafazat, the governorate of Baghdad, we come here not as conquerors, but as liberators, to free you from generations of tyranny. You see? Faintly. It didn't say George W. Bush, it said General Sir Angus Maud. Maud died shortly afterwards in Baghdad because he drank milk without heating it. He's now buried right next to the Turkish embassy, which got a suicide bombing a couple of years ago. But what happened? There was an insurgency against British rule in 1920. The first British officer was killed near Abu Ghraib, Captain Townsend. He was actually killed at a village called Handari, which I know very well because in the summer of 2003, I went to Handari because it was the place where the first American soldier was killed by a roadside bomb. And in the vast crowd of people there to whom I was trying to talk, because they were witnesses to this, his blood was still on the road, one young man came up to me and said, my grandfather was the man who killed Captain Townsend, just over there. In retaliation, the British besieged with artillery a city called Fallujah. This is 1920. We also, because we were very good at this at the time, we also besieged Najaf, where we demanded the surrender of a Shiite cleric called Badr. We got badder. You didn't get sadder. But nevertheless, you can see the parallels. In 1920, British military intelligence sent a telegram, which I've seen, to the War Department in London, saying that terrorists were crossing the Iraqi border from... Right, Syria. So you knew what British military intelligence said in 1920. Amazing. In the British House of Commons, because the occupation by Britain was becoming very unpopular in my home country. Soldiers were dying. Of course, they were buried on the scene. There were no refrigerators to bring them back then. Very expensive. The First World War had already been over for 2 years. Lloyd George stood up in the House of Commons and said, if British troops are withdrawn immediately now from Iraq, there will be... Civil War. You see, again, you knew what Lloyd George said in the British Parliament in 1920. That is amazing, isn't it? No wonder we don't carry history books in our back pocket. There were lots of other parallels. British military intelligence in 1915 said in Basra that we would be welcomed with flowers and songs if we went in against the Ottoman armies. And many of the Iraqis, who of course then were Ottoman soldiers fighting on the Turkish side, found that they were sent to prison camps in India where they were abused by their jailers. You see, this is fingerprint historical parallels, which we will not and do not wish, of course, to acknowledge. Where do we go? Why do we get it wrong? I think journalists should try to be more courageous. I think they should try to work for editors who are brave enough to print what they write. I have a great good fortune in writing for The Independent, which you can read on various websites, even though you have to pay for it if you go to The Independent's website, another reason why I don't use the internet. Well, it helps my budget and lets me fly further. Nonetheless, I'm very fortunate. I have an editor who'll print what I write. Sometimes things go a little bit astray. You take the Toronto Globe and Mail, which popped up not so long ago with an article of mine on the Armenian genocide. But when I referred to the phrase, which I do in The Independent, the Armenian Holocaust, with a capital H, just as we, of course, rightly refer to the Jewish Holocaust with a capital H, the word Holocaust had been deleted, and in its place was tragedy. Like a problem, like a flood, or maybe an earthquake had hit the Armenians, right? So immediately I picked this up. One of my Canadian friends had actually spotted it, called me in Beirut. I called our syndication department. I said, ha-ha, when they take our syndicated services, they're not allowed to change the words. So London called Toronto and said, ha-ha, why did you change the words? And it turned out not only had they changed the word, but the editor had left, which apparently then absolved the Toronto Globe and Mail of actually apologising. And anyway, they hadn't taken the syndication service. They'd just stolen the story anyway. So they had to pay a fine, you know, congratulations. But you'd be surprised how often this happens. Since the Armenians, this is part of an Armenian week, I will say that one of the things I hope will happen, and as a journalist I say this too, is that in the coming months and years, Armenians will try, as Israelis and Jews have tried in Europe, to honour those brave Turks, in the case of the Jews and Israelis, those brave Europeans, who risked their lives to save the people who were stricken. Those Turks, in this case, who risked their lives to save Armenians. We know who some of them were. Of course, that most of them are dead now. I'm sure all dead. But only the children are still alive, and they're fading away now. But we know names, even in the British Blue Book, which was published during the First World War. There is honour paid to Turks who risked their lives to save Armenian lives. And I'm struck to say that because I want to read a very small, tiny paragraph of my own book, because I've gone back and tried to interview almost every survivor of the Armenian genocide Holocaust in Lebanon. I went to the Armenian old people's home. Down the corridor, a very old man is lying on a bed. He is Harutyun Kebedjian. He is holding in his left hand a Bible in Braille, and his right hand is fingering the embossed paper letters. He greets me with a smile, sightlessly. It is now the year 2000, and he is 93 years old. So he was 8 when he survived the Armenian Holocaust. His memory is as clear as his emotions. He said, "We lived in Dortyol. My father was called Sarkis and my mother was Mariam. There were 10 children, including me and my brothers and sisters. The Turks collected all the people with their donkeys and horses. We were to go to Aleppo and Ras El Ain, but they started killing us on the way. The Turks forced us to the Habor River, and by the time we got there, there was only my mother and my sister and me left. They told the women and the men to take off all their clothes. My sister was 18, and a man on a horse came and grabbed her and put her on his horse. He did this in front of us. It happened in front of my eyes. I was not blind then. And they started to beat my mother. As she begged them not to take my sister, the Turks beat her to death. I have always remembered that as my mother died, she screamed my name, Harutyun, Harutyun. Later, an Arab Bedouin took me to his house, and I stayed there for 3 years. The war was over, and then people came saying they were looking for Armenian orphans. I said I was Armenian, so they took me to Aleppo. There I caught a virus that affected my eyes. I was suddenly blind, and I was only 11 years old. Until I was 23, I was filled with rage because the Turks took my sister and beat my mother in front of my eyes until she died. But when I was 23, I felt this was not the right way to be a man. So I began to pray to God so he would see me. I was making peace with myself. Now I'm ready to meet my God. I am at peace. Last year, when the big earthquake happened in Turkey, it killed so many Turks. And I prayed to God for those Turks. I prayed for those poor Turkish people. What a guy. I have to tell you that when I went to cover that earthquake, I found wandering in the earthquake zone of Istanbul a very bright, middle-aged Turkish man with his daughter, spoke beautiful English. And I said, well, what are you doing? What are you doing? He said, well, actually, I'm the top earthquake specialist in Turkey, and they won't even pay my taxi fares to go and see what's happened in my country, the government. So I said, from this moment, you are working for the Independent. So I took this guy around all the earthquake zones. It was an appalling horror. I mean, 40,000, I think, was probably the figure of Turks who died in that earthquake, because, of course, their buildings had been built without proper anti-earthquake protection. And when afterwards he and his family and family friends gathered beside the Bosphorus, I remember I said to them, okay, well, here comes the big question, Armenian genocide. And they all said, yes, of course it happened. Our people were responsible, and we should say so. Well, we'll find out, because in October, the Turkish edition of my book, complete with the Armenian genocide chapter, which is called The First Holocaust, is being published in Turkish. An Armenian who speaks Turkish in Beirut has checked over the translation, and it's perfect. And I will be lecturing on the Armenian genocide across Turkey. So as they say in journalism, watch this space. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll finish by just saying two brief remarks. Firstly, I will not let 19 murderers change my world, and nor should you.
Robert will now take questions from the audience. Just to remind you, Robert will be signing books over here, The Great War for Civilization, as well as Pity the Nation.
Ladies and gentlemen, sorry again about the bits of film. They would have been worth watching. If you have any questions for Uncle Noam, as I always refer to him, but not usually in his presence, please shoot them at him as well. There's always a wonderful moment when no one puts their hand up, but it's already happened. I think there's a mic that's going to run around. There it is. And there's the first person there.
Hello. I thought your talk was wonderful. Could you, based on your experience in Iraq, answer two questions? One is the actual level of what is the actual level of control that U.S. forces have over Iraq relative to the insurgents? And secondly, can you elaborate on the specific ways in which civil war is being fomented and exaggerated by U.S. forces in their interests?
okay, number one, there is no control over the insurgency. From Kirkuk and Mosul in the north down to Basra, as I said, it is a state of total anarchy. There are gunmen on the streets of Baghdad within 550 meters of the Green Zone. Only when you're inside the Green Zone can you believe in the future of Iraq. This is a problem. Those of us who go on the streets understand all too well what the situation is. I'll give you an example from Amara, which is under, quote, British control, unquote. There's a deal being done between the British and the local armed tribesmen that every afternoon at 3:30, a British armoured column will be permitted to drive through the centre of Amara and back to their fort again, and that's the end of British control in Amara. The fact that the British embassy does not allow its staff to drive on the airport road to Baghdad, which is the main supply route for the Americans, tells its own story. Muggins here still drive that road many times, but it is horrifying. You know, there's one human rights worker from this country actually was burned virtually alive and died because of a suicide attack on American mercenaries on that road. There is absolutely no control at all. The American project is finished. It's over. What we've got to look at is the way out now. And in the end, the Americans will need the Iranians and the Syrians to help them, which is one reason, I suspect, why that famous inquiry, which was fingering the Syrian regime into the murder on February 14 last year of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri of Lebanon, seems to have hit the doldrums all of a sudden. However, so much for control. It doesn't exist. What was the second part again? Just remind me. Sorry?
Civil war.
Look, there are clearly armed groups trying to foment civil war. There are clearly areas of Baghdad where families which are not divided by religion are moving away from their neighbours. Sunnis from Shiites, Shiites from Sunnis. And this is a situation that is being paralleled in places like Hilla, Mahmoudiya, to the south of Baghdad, and you see it in places like Samarra to the north and Bakuba and so on. It's not happening on the vast scale that it sounds, but it is happening. And I spoke on the phone to a university lecturer in the English department, Baghdad University, as usual, please don't mention my name, of course, who said to me that he's never known the situation to be so critical. But many Iraqi friends of his, he's a Sunni and his friends are Shia, are all saying to each other, stay together, stay together. Find out who is trying to break us apart. I have to tell you a brief note here, just a bit of jocularity in the middle of Iraq, that this same professor, number two in the English department, invited me to give a lecture to his English students not so long ago. And I said, look, as long as you don't tell them in advance I'm coming, and as long as people, students from Fallujah are there, that the insurgency resistance, call it what you like, terrorists, are present, I don't mind. He said, no one will know. So, of course, you can imagine on the Saturday morning when I turned up at Baghdad University and got out at the main gate and saw a big poster in Arabic that said, 9 o'clock this morning, English department, Robert Fisk. Nothing happened. But no, look, I have to plan a trip out of Baghdad for 2 weeks before I make it by road. That's how bad it is. There is no protection, no control, no safety, no security. You know, We say, oh, we're going to have a new constitution. We'll move Mr. Jafari out. We'll bring someone else in. Ordinary Iraqis are sitting in their homes trying to make sure their wives and children are not kidnapped and murdered. And that's what they're concerned about. How about someone right at the back there? Right back there. I want to make you walk and run as far as possible. Right at the back. Right at the back. You can see the hand? It seems to be blue in the clothing, but I'm not sure. That's because I'm wearing my reading glasses.
Thank you so much. I have enormous respect for your work, Mr. Fisk. But I can't help feel that I need to challenge you on a certain point.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
You keep discussing the 9/11 event as something that was not orchestrated by the United States government. Mm. I think there's a lot of evidence at the moment to prove that there are a lot of unanswered questions about
the government,
the United States government's involvement, if not the setup of the 9/11 event bombing. And I really, what we need is people like you here in the media to start asking real questions and to start getting real answers.
Well, you don't need Bob Fisk. You've got Cy Hirsch, haven't you, whom I can't match. He's a really great journalist. Look, Every time I give a talk in the United States especially, but also in Europe, I get questions almost identical to yours. There are vast numbers of secret things about the 11th of September 2001, which we don't know. And I don't know why we don't know. And of course, I'm suspicious about it. But I do think bin Laden was involved. Now, whether you can conclude from that, that maybe there was a kind of idea in the administration that something would happen, and that if it happened, then we know how we proceed with the agenda from there, or whether you want to take the conspiratorial view of history that it was all set up by the administration, which I will not believe unless it can be proved to me. You know, there are clearly many questions that have not been answered and which those in power do not want you to know the answers to. If I was based in New York, believe me, this would be my daily story, but I'm based in Beirut, and you have your journalists who have to do that job, and you have to persuade them to do it. Lady there. Yeah, hang on, let's just come with the mic. Not that you'll need it in this auditorium, but still.
Someone said, if you want to know what's happening in Iraq, you have to follow the bulldozers.
So you have to what, sorry?
The bulldozers. There are no construction. The money, I want to know where the money of oil is going. Mm. They are not doing anything for Iraqi people. Mm. And they must have some revenue if there is of oil. And I'd just like to know where it goes.
Well, at the moment, Iraq is importing oil from Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. There is no substantial oil export, not sufficient to actually make the kind of money. Remember, Wolfowitz thought that Iraqi oil was going to pay for the war. You're going to pay for it, not Iraqi oil. The key issue, of course, is the Bremer legislation, which effectively meant that foreign oil companies can take over the oil fields in Iraq, which is obviously one of the reasons for this terrible and suffering people of Iraq in the conflict. At the moment, apart from those people that run mobile phone companies and the real money makers, who are the contractors and mercenaries who are operating, former members of the Special Forces, British SAS, Royal Ulster Constabulary in Northern Ireland, South African Police, etc. Apart from these people, no one is really making any money. It's a rather extraordinary situation because there is Iraq, which is a treasure house of immense wealth, and no one can get the key in the lock to open the box. And they're not going to be allowed to. That's the whole problem at the moment. What is interesting is that, for example, for anyone working in the green zone to leave the green zone and come back, whether they have to do an interview, meet someone, or go to a restaurant, they are charged by the contractors $6,000 a trip. I do the trip all over Baghdad for about, I think it's $150 a day, but I'm with Iraqis, just two, and we have no weapons. But $6,000 is what you pay for an armed escort from the green zone to dinner at night, if you can find anywhere that will serve you, especially if you're a Westerner. So there is no money coming out, and our legislation now means nothing. You see, one of the things that's happened is we set up this vast body of legislation, much of it U.S. legislation, you know, done under the period of Bremer, the second proconsul, Paul Bremer, Jr., the third, or whatever, an expert on anti-terrorism, I seem to remember. And this legislation now means nothing either. It is a fact, and I can tell you, because I know the people involved, that leaders of the insurgency in Jordan have met with oil analysts who are interested to see if they can have a relationship with the insurgents for after the Americans have left. You see, we think, oh, the insurgents or rebels or terrorists, you call them what you like, they want to get the Americans out. Yes, they do, but that's not the purpose. The purpose is to get the Americans out so that afterwards they can say, we have a right to rule this country because we saved it from occupation. The FLN was not fighting the French to end French occupation. It was fighting the French so that later it could say, we have power in this country now that we have driven the French out. And they still have power to this day. And that is what is happening. We are seeing the beginning. Iraqis are going to stay in Iraq. And they're already planning what's going to happen after the ultimate tragedy, after the ultimate catastrophe for us. And we're still saying things are getting better. Gentlemen there, it pays to be halfway back in the audience. Here comes the mic. And any questions for Noam as well, please?
Thank you very much for taking my...
Because I want some relief here.
Thank you very much for taking my question, Mr. Fisk. I would like to go back to a comment that you made about learning from history, carrying history books in your suitcase.
And I apologize for the British Empire at this point, by the way.
Thank you very much. But you know, again, when I look at the history of the subcontinent and I look at the history of colonialism and the after effects of that it left. My question to you, and I ask this more as a political analyst as well as a well-informed journalist, what makes the Americans think this time that they could play it differently from all other colonial powers in the past?
I think that when you are a superpower, and much more to the point, when you are the world's only major superpower, which the British were for a time, and which the Romans definitely were in the known world, I think you have this boundless optimism that you can do what you want to do. And you also have this feeling that everyone else wants to be like you, and therefore it'll be okay. Now, sometimes when I'm in Cairo, for example, I can see the problem in all this, because while I open Al-Ahram, and there's another paean of scorn for the United States, I can also drive past the American embassy and see a massive queue of Arabs around the outside waiting for visas and green cards. They love America so much they want to come here, but they hate it so much they're going to condemn it every morning in Al-Ahram. And there is a problem there in the sense that you go to Dahran and the highways, or Jeddah, and the highways look like L.A., and the road signs are identical to road signs on the M60 north of London. You can see why we go there. So look, it's just like home. We wouldn't say that about Iraq, by the way, but nonetheless. And there is this constant idea that they want to be like us. Hence, we want to give them democracy. And actually, I think most Arab Muslims would like democracy. They'd like some packages of human rights off our Western supermarket shelves. But they want another kind of freedom, I think, and that is freedom from us. And this we will not give them. I looked up in my files the other day, since I don't use the hated Google and internet, I looked up in my paper files to find any reference to the key word justice, which is what you found freedom and democracy on, and which is so lacking in the Middle East. There's an awful lot of injustice. And there was only one reference to justice, which I found among the works of George W. Bush and Tony Blair. And that was the name of a military operation called Operation Infinite Justice. That's the problem. Lady here in the black and white.
Could you, changing the subject for...
Well, thank goodness for that.
Maybe not even quite changing it.
Can you talk more into the mic, because I can't
hear you. For either you or Professor Chomsky, say a few words about where you see Armenia today in terms of the... Iran, the United States and its positioning against Iran, where Armenia is bordered by Iran on the south and its only friendly neighbor at this time. Where does that put Armenia, and what is the game? What do you see as the game that is going on, if I may call it game in quotes,
you know,
between Russia and...
I think...
Can you hear me?
Oh.
We have to move our mics.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Well, the answer is pathetically simple. The game is, if Armenia decides to become a great democracy, like, say, Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan and so on, meaning it follows orders from the White House, then, okay, it'll be treated just like them. If it doesn't, it'll be smashed. In fact, we even know this from high U.S. government sources, not with regard to Armenia, but with regard to every other case you can think of. Take, say, the bombing of Serbia in 1999, Clinton administration. Well, it was like everyone, you know, Stalin, Hitler, everybody. It was for humanitarian reasons. That collapsed instantly as soon as the Western documentation came out. In fact, you can see it from the Milosevic trial, obviously a murderous gangster, but the charges against him in Kosovo were from after the bombing. There was one exception. The entire charges. Yeah, after the bombing, it was expected the bombing would escalate atrocities, and it did. Okay, so that's, but what are the reasons? Well, there's actually a good source on that now, which you're not going to find discussed much. Strobe Talbot, who was the head of the Brookings Institution, was the highest official in the Clinton administration responsible for the diplomacy in this period. He was head of the Pentagon, State Department, task forces, supervising it and so on. He just wrote an introduction to a book in which he said, the book was written by his director of communications, in which he says, this is the book you have to, something like this, this is the book you have to read if you want to understand how the Kosovo-Serbia affair was viewed at the highest level of the Clinton administration. Okay, so you look at the book by his director of communications, John Norris, and he says, words approximately like this, he says, there was no humanitarian concern in the bombing of Serbia after Kosovo. He said the problem was that Serbia was not carrying out the appropriate political and economic reforms. Okay, in other words, it wasn't accepting the U.S. neoliberal package. So therefore, we invented some humanitarian concerns and bombed them. So now they'll accept it. Yeah, that's the way the world works. And it'll work that way as long as we allow it to.
Let's go for the gentleman in the blue shirt there.
Thanks. It's a shame to have you here and not hear you talk about the last events in Lebanon. Could you just elaborate on where do you see it going, the ramifications for the region? I know, but it's one of the only hopeful...
No, I live there. I have a vested interest. Yeah.
Reform from within.
Okay, Lebanon. I'll go as quickly as I can. I guess I take a personal interest because I knew Rafik Hariri pretty well. In fact, when I was beaten up on the border of Afghanistan, he was the second person to call me. This is the former prime minister who was murdered last year, to say, I will send my personal jet. President Pervez Musharraf is a friend of mine. And since we don't take gifts from prime ministers, I said, no, thank you, but good of you to call. I saw him on fire after the bomb killed him. I was 400 meters away, because I'd hurt my back. I was taking some exercise on the Corniche, and it blew up. He blew up in his convoy right in front of me. And everybody who's been murdered since in Lebanon, I know personally. I believe that Ba'ath Party security was involved in his murder, using, of course, Lebanese officials who were loyal to Syria. I don't think President Bashar al-Assad said, you know, who will rid me of this meddlesome prime minister? No. Although there appear to have been threats from the presidency, which Walid Jumblatt constantly recounts, like the threat to him, which was, tell Walid I have my Druze too, etc. I have to say that actually after, I got so quickly to the scene of the bombing, I actually saw the first policeman arrive and start taking the bits of metal out of the crater and putting them in their pockets. They were removing the evidence from the scene of the crime. I also have to say, I then named the three top Lebanese I believe were probably involved in the killing, Lebanese senior officers and security services, which the Lebanese press heroically then reported, Fisk says the following did the crime. And that was a good wake-up call in the morning. I then learned that General Tufaili, who was the head of the Ecouteur at the Amnalam, the head of the listening section of the General Security, had put a tap on my home phone number. So I wrote a story about him and said, since you often get phone numbers wrong, it's 370615 Beirut. So yes, I am a little bit taken by the Lebanon story. I think that the fact that the civil war did not restart after Hariri's murder was a great sign of Lebanon's maturity. I believed when I saw those bodies, I saw people burning in their cars to death. They were being cremated in front of me. I thought that the ghosts of every mass grave were climbing out of the tombs. And it didn't happen because the Lebanese do not and will not tolerate another civil war, though they've still got to learn why the civil war happened. You know, when Al Jazeera, the only television station in the Middle East, brave enough to say, we're going to do a whole series of archive films on how the Lebanese civil war happened, the Corniche in front of my house, packed with hundreds of thousands of people every night, suddenly was empty. Everyone had gone home to watch television to see why they were killing each other. Not a bad example of Al Jazeera's effect on the Middle East. But I think it's in a very dangerous situation because these negotiations that are going on, which began with, you know, Aoun having tea with Nasrallah and Jumblatt having tea with Zsa Zsa and so on and so forth, I think they're not turning out. I had dinner with Jumblatt only 5 days ago. It feels like 5 weeks, in which he was deeply critical of Nasrallah's performance, especially of the issue of Sheba Farms. I think Lebanon remains in a very tense situation, and I think if there were more assassinations, especially, and I will not name them, if there are certain people I can think about, there is a danger of there being a form of sectarian fighting starting. There is a huge army in Lebanon now, big enough, I would have thought, to probably liberate Baghdad, but nonetheless, because of course it is formed of all the different sectarian groups, largely Shiite, of course, because it is the largest community, that army could not move in against a real civil outbreak of civil fighting, because of course the soldiers would feel that their allegiances were to their own people rather than to the nation. They might not. They're pretty good, the Lebanese army, actually, despite all the things that are heaped upon them, but it would be a great danger. So I watch the situation like you do, and I listen to the words of Sister Syria like we all do. Someone said to me the other day, is it free in Beirut now? And I said, well, actually, I said, you know, beforehand, before the Syrians left, when we were talking over lunch, we would go like this, and now we just go like this. It's an improvement. It's a definite improvement. The gentleman here in the black.
How do you think the U.S. should get out of Iraq?
Well, now and today is the time zone. Look, they've got to talk to their opponents in the insurgency. Not al-Qaeda. The Iraqis will have to deal with al-Qaeda. That's something else. But I mean, I met three of the leaders of the insurgency. You call it what you like, terrorists, resistors, rebels, whatever, in a neighboring country. Not Syria, but Jordan, actually. And two of them spoke beautiful English because they were all three were former officers in the Iraqi army who had trained 8 years, you know, living and dying, fighting another superpower called Iran, an invasion we supported. So we were very keen on them fighting in that. They got all the training they needed. One of them, the first guy walked in, he was an ex-general, or still regards himself as a general. He was the man who commanded Fallujah in the second American attack in November. And he walked in and said, "Ah, Mr. Robert, we meet again." And I said, "We haven't met before." He said, "Oh, yes, we have." He said, "You were on the Iraqi front line under fire at the beginning of the Iran-Iraq war, and I was the man who brought the first tank unit across the Karun River into Iran, and you climbed on my tank and interviewed me. And back in Beirut, I went back through my files, and there he was, you see, even had his real name." These guys are trained in Britain and America. They can talk okay in English. You don't even need a translator. They will talk. If they're talked to. You know, we will say, okay, we never talk to terrorists, we don't talk to terrorists, we don't talk to terrorists. That's what we said about the North Vietnamese. That's what we said about the North Koreans. That's what we said about Aoka in Cyprus. It's what we said about Irgun in Palestine. It's what we said about Mau Mau in Kenya. It's what we said about the IRA in Belfast. They all end up having tea with the Queen and visiting 10 Downing Street. That's how we do it. And that's how you'll do it the other way around. You'll get out and you'll negotiate. Even now, we've got a situation where, for example, in places like Mosul, and this is a fact, you've got junior US officers who have an understanding via third parties that if you don't fire mortars at us tonight, we won't do a foot patrol in that street tomorrow morning. So you've already got a kind of matrix of contacts, and everyone knows who everyone else is. It's like the whole thing about, you know, Hamas, Israel won't talk to Hamas. Well, Israel's always been talking to Hamas. Just shortly after the Oslo Agreement, a senior officer in the Israeli army went to talk to one of the major Hamas leaders outside Jerusalem. It was on the front page of the Jerusalem Post. When I was interviewing Hamas members who'd been thrown into Lebanon by 1993, I remember I was interviewing them for my paper, and I said, well, I'm off to Israel tomorrow, see what the effect was. And the effect was that one of them ran up to his tent, came back with a notebook, and said, "Do you need Shimon Peres's home number?" And it was Shimon Peres's home number. So they talk. And believe me, the Americans are talking now to people through, and I'm talking, the insurgents, the actual Iraqi insurgents, are the soldiers of the Iraqi army who fought the Iranians between 1980 and 1988, which was mainly our idea. I'm going to run out of steam quite soon, and it's good to see Doug nodding his head. Wait a minute, I'll take two more, just two. Gentleman there in the yellow. Nope, that one over there in the yellow. And then you afterwards. A gentleman in the yellow with his hand up there. Orange, sorry.
I can see. Thank you very much, Dr. Fisk. It's been an absolute pleasure to listen to your, to read to your writing and to come to this lecture. We all know that America is going to leave Iraq. There's very little doubt of that. What about Iran?
Okay. First of all, yes, the Americans will leave, the Americans must leave, and of course the Americans can't leave, which is the equation which turns sand into blood. Iran. I think Iran is part of the wallpaper that we are being fed to keep our eyes off other countries like Pakistan. Pakistan, which has a nuclear scientist and a friend of Pervez Musharraf that was going around the Arab world offering nuclear facilities, but we don't care about. We're no war crimes trials, no process, no tribunal for him, or indeed for Mr. Musharraf, who's a personally a very likable chap, but, you know, but. Much of the northwest frontier provinces are effectively run by Islamists of the bin Laden Wahhabi persuasion. I mean, they got elected, didn't they? We love elections in the Middle East. We just get so annoyed when the pesky Palestinians elect Hamas and the Egyptians go for the Muslim Brotherhood. And then, you know, then the Lebanese elect members of Hezbollah. It's a big problem. You love democracy and then they vote for the wrong people. And that's one of the problems in the local government elections on the Northwest Frontier Province and Balochistan in Pakistan. And that's where the real danger lies. They got a bomb and they have it, which means they're safe, of course, from us. Just as North Korea. We're not going to invade North Korea because they've got a bomb. Iran has not actually done anything illegal yet. But if I was an Iranian, I'd try to get a bomb quickly to stop the Americans turning up. However, just one thing. Remember, when the first American tanks arrived in Baghdad, in April of 2003, we didn't know whether they were going to turn right to Tehran or left to Damascus. They ain't going anywhere now except for home. The Iraqi insurgency has saved Syria and Iran from any possibility of a ground invasion. Bombing, that's something else. One more. The gentleman over there, and then I'm going to...
Thank you.
Work out which country I'm in.
My respect to both of you for your courage, doctors, and also for your... conscientiousness. My question to Dr. Fisk is, how do you feel about being a foreign journalist being invited to Turkey to speak while other journalists in Turkey are being persecuted?
I have spoken in Turkey before, and I have talked about the Armenian genocide at some length during a lecture in Istanbul, which was actually supported by Sabancı University, the private university in Istanbul. And after I finished speaking, one of the members of the audience who said he was a retired general in the Turkish army said I was absolutely correct in what I said about the Armenian genocide. I think the page is turning in Turkey. I think it's a great honor to be invited to speak in Turkey, and I look forward to it very much. That's the answer to your question. Okay, Doug, I think we're... Unless you have something to say...